It's lovely to see everybody. Thank you. Is anybody new here tonight for the first time? Huh? Cool. Welcome. We're a little strange, but you'll get used to it. Certainly, we mean you no harm. Thank you for sitting with us tonight. And, you know, there's a lot of form and ritual to our practice, but it's really beginners and people who have been doing this a while, who are still, all of us are really still beginners. We're all here really just to do the same thing, which is to practice meditation as a way to go inside so that we can be more face front outside as well. So, Richard, do you think, could I ask you to turn the light on for me?
I'm sorry.
So for those of you that are new, my name is Dana, and you know, I realize every time I sit in this seat, I get a little bit nervous. It's funny because I teach at the university, and this quarter I have two classes of over 200 people. And it's big, you know, kind of stadium-style seating type thing, and microphones, and lots of computers, and screens, and document cameras, and all this stuff that I can kind of hide behind when I'm teaching, which is really good for me. So I am actually very delighted to be here. I love our Sangha. I love working with you, practicing with you, disagreeing with you sometimes, and learning from you. So I realize when I'm teaching, whether it's up at the university or here, I often forget to breathe. I don't know, you have this is a problem, actually. Forgetting to breathe, because it shows up in all these places and all these ways, in your body, in your mind. Pretty simple thing, really, inhale, exhale, but kind of a big difference between inhaling completely and exhaling completely. And I was thinking as I was offering incense, you know, when we get used to the routines and the forms that we do in the Zendo, they become kind of automatic. Bow to the cushion, bow away from the cushion, you know, do kinhin at this time, do this when the bell rings, and so on. And, you know, one of the things I've been thinking is just the forms that we have, it's a kind of structure for us to fall in or fall apart in, so that we don't have to think so much about what we're doing. But there really is a big difference between offering incense and offering incense. There's a big difference between bowing and doing a prostration and bowing completely and doing a prostration. Once during a practice period, I heard the practice leader say, you know, the Zendo is full. There's like 70 people there. We're all tired and cold. And she says something like, she said it very skillfully. She said, you know, sometimes I notice when I bow, I go down on the mat and I put my head on the ground and I raise my hands to lift the Buddha's feet, and then maybe, because I'm in a hurry, I put them down like this. And I drop the Buddha, or I'm kind of sideways. And so she was sort of giving us an instruction to do a bow completely. And this is how my mind works. What I remember her saying was, you know, a lot of people bow and do the lift the Buddha's feet, and then on the way up they remembered that this itches. or they decide this is a good time to like adjust the robes or something like that. And she says, when you do extra things like that, then you're not doing something completely, because you're kind of like, it's like multitasking on a prostration. So these subtle differences about, you know, with regard to offering incense or bowing or even chanting, these are all kind of lifetime practices, I think. And one of the things I want to talk about tonight is about Dharma, studying Dharma. What does it mean to study Dharma, or to study Dharma completely? How do we make that distinction, and how do we kind of understand what that is? And I guess by way of introduction, I should confess to you that I've been thinking a lot about death recently. A lot of Buddhists do this, don't we? We think about death. Like, it's part of the practice to think about the great matter, birth and death, and everything in between. And, you know, in our own lives, when the great matter is up or right before us, it always is there. But when it's right in front of us, then often everything else falls away. And we do the priorities and make the time and do what's necessary to address and kind of prepare ourselves and our families for the great matter. And really what we're doing is we're trying to sync up, in a way, everything that we know about practice with what is actually going on in our day-to-day lives. One of the reasons I've been thinking about death is about a month ago, someone that I knew back when I was 18, which was a long time ago, I learned that he was diagnosed with cancer in December, and he died in early March. And this is a man who I shared quite a bit of history with, and he and I and maybe, I don't know, 10 or 12 other people were students in the first class in Japanese American history at UC Berkeley. And actually, I think this was the first class offered in Japanese American history in California, in the United States, in the world, ever. So we all felt like we were part of this historic thing. And, you know, we stayed in touch. Our intellectual and professional paths crossed now and then. And I didn't know Gerald super well, although, you know, there are times when we were in pretty close contact with one another. And what I learned about his death, I went to his memorial service, was that while he was a very public person, he became a vice chancellor or vice president at Chabot College. When he got sick, he completely isolated himself. And even his closest friends did not know that he was sick, or that he was, you know, going through a chemo radiation routine to try to halt the cancer or slow the cancer. And even one of his best friends, who is a mutual friend of mine, said to me that, you know, he had been trying to contact Gerald for months because they always watched, what's the big football game? The Super Bowl, together in January. But that Gerald wouldn't call him back. And that finally Gerald's wife called our friend Jerry and said, you better get over here because I think it's going to be soon. So one of his closest friends even didn't see him until a day or two before he died. And, you know, I found that very sad in a way. And I think that's a little bit of my putting like an evaluation or judgment on it, but I know that he must have felt, you know, like he was keeping a secret. And people were very shocked when, you know, lots of people found out that he had passed away. But the memorial service was actually very lovely. You know, we did all those things you do at a regular memorial service. We laughed, we cried, we told, like, stories we shouldn't have told about him and that kind of thing. And it was a really beautiful service in that. So this guy, I should just say, he was very unusual, Japanese-American. He looked like a gangster. Like, I think he was 63 or something like that at the time that he died. He had been sporting a mullet hairdo since college. And he always wore this kind of very dark pair of Ray-Bans. And he was a huge guy. So he's very intimidating. You always knew that he was in the room. People were a little bit, you know, intimidated by him, even though he was completely kind of a marshmallow when you got to know him. So this, I was really struck. So it turns out he was kind of a closet Buddhist. And a priest that the family knew at the memorial spoke and gave him a Dharma name. And since it was kind of news to pretty much everyone that was there that he was a closet Buddhist, I mean, they're still sort of reeling from the shock that he passed away and that he was sick. They, I don't think, had a huge clue as to what was going on with that. But the feeling in the room was very sweet. You know, people were open-hearted, generous. You know, people that I didn't know, we talked, just as a way to kind of have that connection. And I was really struck with, wouldn't that be nice if that's how we were with one another? It takes the great matter to kind of open us up and bring that forth. So the other reason I've been thinking about death and dying a lot is I've been studying the ancestors. And for those of you that are new, we have a lot of ancestors. So the founder of this school of Zen, Dogen Zenji, lived in the 1200s. There's 24 generations of Chinese ancestors before Dogen, and then there's Indian ancestors before the Chinese ancestors, and then there are Japanese and Western ancestors since Dogen. So if you really, you know, take this up in a serious way, you're looking at a big stack of books and history and biographies and, you know, about 2 or 3 years ago, you know, it's been so long now, I can't even remember if it is 2 or 3 years ago, I decided to take this up because, you know, I was interested in what are the awakening stories? What are the enlightenment stories of our forebears, our the lineage that's part of Soto Zen? And I found a number of kind of surprising things since I began the study. And so what I would like to do tonight is talk to you a little bit about my study of the ancestors. First, you know, for those of you who come here or have been here and been to a ceremony of some kind or sat sesshin or possibly been at morning service, you know that we do a lot of ancestor stuff here. So one day a week we chant the male ancestors and the female ancestors. It's a pretty weighty list, and really, it's only like a drop in the bucket. Like I say, we're talking about 2,500 years worth of ancestors. But the kind of top shelf ones are in our sutra books. And so we do that once a week. And for ceremonies, like yesterday's full moon ceremony, kind of renewal of the bodhisattva vows, we chanted the names of Buddha. And we also do this during sesshin for various services and events like meals. So, and we, you know, we didn't used to do the ancestor chant in the morning. I remember this is a relatively new thing in the last 4 or 5 years. Is that about right? Something like that. I think when Catherine was alive and leading services a lot, I think she thought it was a little over the top to chant the ancestors. And so, I don't know, some of you remember this from the old days. Back in the day, and during we would finish morning meditation and service, and we would break for 10 minutes of temple cleaning, And she would, at least during one period, retreat to the Dokusan room, and you could hear her chanting the ancestors. And honestly, I always thought it was a little weird. Probably others of you did not. I thought, well, maybe she's just doing this so that when we go to Tassajara, she's not going to have a chant book right in front of her face. And so, but it was a practice. I understand that better now. So anyway, I started this study of the ancestors, and I've done some with Kathy, who also took up this study. And, you know, I feel like this long list of ancestors, their histories, their stories, who passed what kind of transmission of Dharma to what heir, and so on. I feel like I know this much, and there's like this much. Like it's almost inconceivable, the amount of knowledge that that is sitting out there. And so one of the things I did is I wanted to learn to memorize the ancestors' names. And I know some of you chant without a chant card. You know how, do you remember the days when you had a chant card in front of you and then you thought, I want to chant without a chant card because it's a different experience. And it is, right? Because when you're reading and chanting, it's different than when you're just chanting. Well, that hasn't honestly gone that well. This memorizing thing, rote memorization. I have little 3x5 cards, and sometimes I keep them. I don't have them on me right now, but I keep them in my sleeve, and I have them in my backpack, and I have them on my desk at school and my desk at home. And then, not to be outdone by kind of the potential of technology, I put a voice memo on my phone in which I chanted the male ancestors and female. Anyway, it really hasn't gone very well. I don't do it enough, but maybe I'm partway through. And then, I don't know, for those of you that are learning to memorize a chant, do you get stuck at some place? Yeah, well, dude, I'm stuck. Like about, 40% through or somewhere around there. So as many of you know, or maybe some of you don't know, death and dying are a important part of ancestor histories and ancestor kind of summary, biographical summaries. And, there's not really a whole lot known historically, like really long detailed books about the ancestors. There probably is actually in Chinese and Sanskrit. But what's available to us in English is quite a bit more limited. But, you know, these descriptions of the ancestors are typically fairly short, like between 1 and 5 pages, and they talk about their life, their struggles, their teachers, their entering a monastery, maybe something about their awakening experience, and then often something about their death. And the stories that include the death scenes are, I think, as far as I can tell, based on what I've done so far, are of two types. One, there's this really dramatic kind of scene in which, someone dies in a particularly, I want to say, dramatic or violent or kind of what would be, I think, for most of us, a kind of shocking way. And then there's the more pastoral, bucolic kind of so-and-so passed away and then lived ephemerally in the trees for the next 300 centuries. So those are the two kinds of death scenes. And I wonder, would you mind if I read you a couple of these? So the first one I want to read is a little bit of Mahaprajapati. Mahaprajapati is our first female, all of these are female ancestors, is our first female ancestor. She's a contemporary of the Buddha, of Siddhartha. And we recite her name every day in service after the Heart Sutra. She has this sort of fantastic um, She's the ancestor who really advocated for kind of women being ordained and having kind of equal sangha time, and I'll just read you a couple passages so you can get a flavor of how these stories go. Some years later, she sat down under a tree with Siddhartha and asked that he revoke the rule requiring nuns to be subject to monks, no matter who was the senior. It was time, she thought, for the women's community to be given more power. He refused. Such a thing had never been seen before, he said. Never in the history of this world had there been a community of people with power divided equally between men and women. He knew not what would come in the 21st century, but anyway. Okay, and he says, accept it for now as it is. It won't always be that way. So Pajapati lived to be 120 years old. One day she suddenly remembered all her past lives, reviewed this one, and realized it was coming to an end. At that moment there was an earthquake and a pounding rain. The wind sounded like people crying. When she asked her stepson for permission to die, all the people began to cry. Show us a miracle, Siddhartha said, for any fool who still thinks women can't attain enlightenment like men. So she split into many bodies, became invisible, walked through a tree, levitated, and made great heat. Then she lay down, ready to die. Sundarinanda put her head on her mother's lap while Pajapati entered a succession of samadhi states until she was gone. Flowers fell, mountains shook, and at her funeral, the sun, moon, and stars were all visible in the sky. So I don't know, that's, you know, it's sort of dramatic, but not awful, right? I like the splitting into many bodies and levitating. So the person that I've been reading about most recently is a woman named Dhamma, Acharya Dhamma. And she's also called Old Bones. That's sort of her, what do you say, moniker or something like that. And she's someone who was born into a family. She married someone who was very, I guess, well off. She had a lot of things. Kind of thinking, how many things could you have at that time? But she had a lot of things. But she was very unhappy, and she wanted to be released from her marriage so that she could become a monk or a nun and possibly be ordained. And she was very kind of, she wanted to, you know, to vow to live without things. And so she asked her husband, and he said no. And then every year after, she asked him again and again if she could leave the marriage and go join a monastery, and he said no. So after he died, she joined a monastery. And after a while, finding without surprise that the life agreed with her completely, Dhamma took on the practice of following even the optional rules as carefully as possible. I think that means like after you know, Sasheen is done for that day, she did night sitting or something. The monastic rules for both men and women were largely negatives, things not to do, actions to avoid. Dhamma lived her life within the structure of a set of guidelines that were prescriptive and positive, regulating almost every action, from eating and sleeping to interacting with other people. Her heart filled with joy in the narrow space of these rules, where she felt unbounded and free and quite young. She had thought that this life of stricture, freely chosen, would be very different from the life she'd unwillingly led for so long. But now there was one more surprise. She was past this too. She'd learned the lesson the young nuns hadn't, that the one everyone has to learn. No form is special. Every life meets itself, coming and going, and can't be escaped. On begging rounds one day, she tripped and fell. Her old bones were like the foam on fresh milk. She fell spinning, hit the dusty ground, and heard her bones snap. Then her mind opened completely, with terrible pain and terrible clarity. And before she died, a short time later, she gathered the other nuns around her and recited a poem. I wandered every day, shaking and weary, leaning on a staff, weak all over. When I fell, I could see all at once, the body is misery, but the heart is free. So, not too dramatic, but dying in a heap of broken bones, that doesn't... Ouch. So will you bear with me? I'd like to read you one more. So one of our Japanese, there's a list of Japanese ancestors. I was going to pick the bathhouse attendant for you, Patrice, but I chose a woman instead named Eshun, Acharya Eshun. The irresistible one is how she was known. She wanted to be ordained by her brother, who was a monk at a Japanese temple. But he said no, maybe in part because it wasn't kind of the convention to ordain women, but also because it turns out she was exquisitely beautiful. And so she cut her hair and she took like a hot poker and she burnt and scarred her face and entered a monastery. Her brother agreed then to allow her to enter this monastery as a nun. And I guess, you know, there were these like congress gatherings of monks. So people from one temple would go to another temple and there would be a gathering of monks. And so she wanted to go to this big gathering at a temple that was known for being a little bit rowdy, you know. And so she strikes an agreement with her brother that she can represent her temple and go to this other temple. So the day of the Congress, she climbed the long, wide steps and walked through the great gate. A monk jumped out from behind a rock, threw his robes open, and exposed himself, shouting, "My monk's thing is 3 feet long. How about taking it on?" I'm sorry, I should have said this is kind of a R-rated lecture. So Eshun immediately threw open her nun's robes and answered, "This nun's thing has no bottom." And all the monks watching from their hiding places were embarrassed and skulked away. So a few days later, the entire community was gathered in the meditation hall for a Dharma talk. Eshun came in last, completely naked. All the monks watched her in stupefaction while she walked calmly down the center aisle until she reached her admirers. "Well," she asked in a loud voice, "if you really love me, take me now. It's nothing to be ashamed of, is it?" And so the monk that had done his, you know, exposing, jumped up from his seat, ashamed, and ran away from the monastery forever. And after that, Eshun was mostly left alone. When she was old and getting close to death, she asked several monks to make a wood pile for a bonfire in her yard. To her shock, she then sat down in the center and set fire to it. Her brother rushed out of his room and up to the edge of the flames, but they were too intense. Through the blinding hot light, he could see her sitting in perfect stillness. "My sister," he shouted. She turned her head slowly. The skin on her face and hands was beginning to bubble and split. "Is it hot in there?" he said. That seems like kind of a crazy thing to say, you know. It's like, duh, does it look hot in here? "Is it hot in there?" he said. And they both knew what he meant. She was going to a place where nothing is hot or cold. "For one living in the way," she answered, her voice just carrying over the crackle of flames and popping wood. "Hot and cold are nothing to fear. There is no need to ask that question." And then she burnt to death, following her beauty into emptiness. So, I don't know if this will be encouraging or discouraging. if you want to take up studying the ancestors. You know, these stories are so amazing and they're very moving, even though, you know, some of these stories are 2,000 years old. So let me go back to what is the difference between studying Dharma and studying Dharma completely? And I think I can't lecture on this as if it were a universal thing. I can only tell you my experience of it. And if you take up studying some of the ancestors, you'll have to find how it is for you. You know, I started this study as like a Dharma heritage history project, because that's how I understood how we relate to the ancestors, that they are our historical lineage, and that to study them is to honor them, to know their transmission stories, their enlightenment stories, to know how they died is a way for us to be informed about how their practice has cultivated and set the ground for this practice. But things turned out a little bit differently, and let me just kind of suggest a couple ways in which they were different. First, I thought I was studying sages, enlightened ones. You know, the ones who are the holders and the keepers of this great thing that we call, you know, awakening and enlightenment, nirvana. And it turns out that really what I'm reading about, or think I'm reading about, is very ordinary people who also happen to be monks, but people who practice and went beyond, but also have kind of, you know, really typical stories that we would have about being trapped in a family, being in an unhappy relationship, wanting a life different than this one, wanting to practice at a different monastery. Kind of in general, you know, if you can imagine all the ways in our own lives or people's lives that you know and love that seem unsatisfactory to them, those were our ancestors. So sages, yes, but ordinary people. I also thought that I was studying the past, right? And this gets a little bit tricky. Kind of the historic lineage of Buddhas and ancestors, the ones to whom we pay homage, give thanks. And it turns out, I think that instead of studying the past, I'm studying the present. And you know, this is sort of a tricky thing to talk about. I thought I was studying them. And it turns out, from where I sit now, that I feel like I'm studying us, like all of us in this room. And I was very, you know, it took me a long time to come to this. Like I say, it's been going on for a couple years. I was very kind of stuck on, okay, what did Makakasho give to Vashumitsu? What did Vashumitsu give to Butsudanandai? And, you know, 2,500 years of this is really, that's a lot of stuff to remember about what was given from this person to that person. But really, in a way, the stories are a call for, I believe, me to think about, what did Nettie just give to me when she brought my books to me? And what do I give her in return? What is it that Lori does as Eno for all of us? And what is it that we do in return? What is it that our three Dharma leaders give to us and that we give in return? So all of the kind of relationship, nexus, and network that we have here in this room and then outside this room as well, these kind of parallel in some ways the stories that are about the past, that are meaningful really for us in the present. So finally, and maybe this is not the last thing, but this will be the last thing for tonight, the point that I want to make. I thought I was studying our ancestors, our dead ancestors. And it turns out that they're not dead. So that's kind of a weird thing to say, right? Dead? How can they not be dead? They're not physically here. This is part of the kind of grander vision and teaching in Buddhism, that again, we have somewhat kind of tricky language for this to try to tease and kind of work with our minds around these ideas that we think are really solid, like being dead. And so when I say the ancestors are not dead, it's not exactly true that they're alive either. We would probably say not dead and not dead, not alive and not alive, right? That kind of construction, usually people chew on that for a few years and then come back and say, huh? but let me try to describe the way in which I think that they're not dead. Rather than be a story about the past, about individual lives of people that are physically no longer here, passed away, I think about these stories now as teachings or lessons about time. So when someone transmits to or teaches to or learns from, we're reading about their suffering, their awakening, their dying, in a way, what we're learning is that the past is inclusive of the present in the same way that the present is inclusive of the past. We're more likely to use that last construction, right? This present moment includes all of the past. But to say that the past is inclusive of the present is sort of a little extra wrinkle that Buddhist philosophy adds to this. And maybe a simpler way to describe this is that we understand our Buddhas and ancestors to be throughout space and time. They are everywhere at all times, past, present, and future. And we're used to having, you know, the kind of the physical body as a way to think about what a Buddha and an ancestor is. And these stories, at least for me, they prompt me to think about what it means to be not dead and what it means to be not dead, but here with me. In your forms, and also in their forms, even though they're not physically present. You know, we have these kind of koan things, koans. We have koans and other stories that are teachings about kind of the dualism that we use to describe being dead or alive, right? The most famous one, or kind of the one that I always kind of like shiver at, is the one about Nanchuan and the cat, right? The monks are fighting over the cat, and Nanchuan comes in and says, tell me a word of Zen or something like that, say something. And the monks can't say anything, and so he cuts the cat in half. And I get stuck with that line, he cuts the cat in half. Like, I can't really, I just start dissociating. After that, like, did he really cut the cat? Well, that's how they taught. That's crazy. But the teaching is that Nanchuan is later talking to another monk who, as Nanchuan is relaying this story of what happened and that the monks couldn't say anything and so he slew the cat, this monk puts his sandals on his head and walks out the door. And Nanchuan says, if you had been there, you could have saved the cat, right? You know, one of the ways, maybe it works for you with koans, or maybe it would work for you just reading and chanting sutras. Maybe it would work for you studying the ancestors, or maybe you just were born that way, that you understood time and past and being dead and not dead and being alive and not alive in this way. I wanted to just... you know, during Sesshin, when we, before lecture, we do a special chant, which is a chant by Ehe Dogen for inspiring vow, arousing vow. And this is a verse about our relationship to ancestors. And so those of you who have done this chant, the Ehe Koso Hotsuganmon, will recognize this. May all Buddhas and ancestors be compassionate to us and free us from karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. Buddhas and ancestors of old were as we in the future shall be Buddhas and ancestors. Revering Buddhas and ancestors, we are one Buddha and one ancestor, awakening Bodhi mind, we are one Bodhi mind. Because they extend their compassion to us freely and without limit, we are able to attain Buddhahood and let go of enlightenment. Now, I love this chant, but I think there's a way in which I did not fully appreciate this notion of we are one Buddha and one ancestor. Like, my little mind goes, Kathy, Gabriel, Chuck, but not me. Maybe someday, me, maybe. But we're talking about other people, and not, like, I don't feel that in my guts necessarily. Shohaku Okamura, who's one of the Japanese teachers, teaches in Bloomington. Is that right, Patrick? He says that dharma, the word dharma, refers to two things: the teachings about reality and reality such as it is. And Katagiri Roshi, it's one of Catherine's teachers. He says it a little bit differently. He says dharma is a complicated Buddhist spiritual term that has at least three meanings. When those three meanings are the principle of all existence, all phenomena, visible or invisible, and the teachings themselves. And their words, they have a slightly different kind of formulation of it, but I think they're in agreement here. Their words remind me that while I often use dharma to refer to the stack of teachings, right? This is a stack of teachings. Meaning the stories, the sutras, our chanting, the awakening stories, the transmission stories. It's a very kind of narrow, in some ways, vision of what dharma is. And it's taken me a while, you know, literally reading through these stories, getting stuck on my list of chanting the ancestors in order, to appreciate that if you stick just to the text, you in some ways limit your knowledge of the kind of full, what kind of range of what the teachers are calling dharma. And so let me, in moving toward closing this talk, let me say that, again, return to that the ancestors are not dead, and that, let me again raise this question about the difference between studying dharma and studying dharma completely. Last week I saw a friend of mine who is a chaplain and a priest, and, you know, we're talking most of the afternoon, and at one point she says to me, "Hey, are you afraid of dying?" And without skipping a beat, I said, "Yes, absolutely." And she kind of moved into chaplain mode and said, "Well, what is it exactly that you're afraid of?" And so, you know, we began to talk about kind of the different ways that people die, whether or not it looks painful, whether or not it's painful for others who are around you. And you know, we had a pretty long and interesting conversation about this, and at the end she says, "Yeah, me too." And it just really struck me that, and actually she said one other thing, which is that not only did she think that she had fear about dying, but that that fear showed up in other places in her life, in her kind of daily activities, the ways she related to people. I didn't press her on it, but you know, I thought that was a kind of insightful thing to say, that, you know, the delusions or the problems that we have, they don't show up just in this one little narrow place in our lives, but they tend to kind of become diffused in different ways in our interactions with ourselves and with others. Such a funny thing, you know, we go about our lives, we have a plan, we have ideas about what comes next. And even those of us who study ancestors and are concerned with death and dying, we know this is an inevitability. And yet, when the great matter is not right on the table there, we don't have to do this necessary thing of trying to make what we know and understand from a Dharma point of view kind of square up with the reality such as it is. I thought you might enjoy maybe just a little bit of Dogen and how he views sutras and chanting. I take, by the way, I told you this thing about when my friend asked me, are you afraid of dying? And I said, yeah, I'm... Actually, what I said was, yes, absolutely. I think that's a really kind of good example of how I, at least, think about the future. And when thinking about the future and not being in the present, the kind of sync between Dharma and reality such as it is disappears, right? So I'm not able... I hope that when I am dying, or that when I do die, I'm not so afraid of it, but that, you know, when it's actually happening, that one faces it right then when it's the reality such as it is, perhaps in a different way than when we're anticipating it. You know, it's kind of like when you go on the roller coaster ride and you're chugging up to the top of the Big Dipper, and you're getting a little like that pit thing in your stomach because you know what's going to come next, which is you're going to go on the rapid downhill. Right, so, but when you're on the rapid downhill, that's different than that moment when you're coming up to the rapid downhill, right? The anticipation of it is different. So I'm going to invoke Dogen here as a sharp criticism of the way I began to approach Dharma study as a kind of history, as a past, as a lineage. He really has quite a sharp tongue, I have to say. What does he say? Also, do you understand the merit attained by the act of reading sutras, chanting Buddha's name, and so on? It is hopeless to think that just moving the tongue and making a sound is meritorious Buddhist activity. If you regard these as the Buddha's teaching will be further and further away. To try foolishly to reach the Buddha way by the practice of chanting myriad times is just like trying to go to the southern country of Yue with your spear headed towards the north, or to fit a square post into a round hole. To look at letters but be ignorant of the way of practice is just like a physician forgetting how to prescribe medicine. What use can it be? People who chant all the time are just like frogs, croaking, day and night in spring fields. Their effort will be of no use whatsoever. Even worse off are those who, deluded by name and gain, cannot give up such practices because their greed for gain is so deep. There were such people in the past, and there are there not even more. What a pity indeed. Oof, kind of glad I wasn't in his monastery. You know, I hope you won't walk away tonight and think that, well, Dana doesn't revere the Buddhas and ancestors. They're just ordinary people. So I want to finish by saying I do revere the Buddhas and ancestors. Those of you who have been to service or been in a ceremony with us, you know that we call the male ancestors Daisho, which is an honorific, and we call the female ancestors, we precede chanting their name by saying Acharya, great teacher. And so we say Shakyamuni, Butsu, Daisho when we do Catherine's name. She's the only woman who is not on the women's list, but on the male ancestor list. We say Karin, Sobun, Daisho. And although we say that ranks don't matter, right, we always say that, right? No difference, lay, ordained, ordinary people, people of kind of high standing and... in Buddhism, although we say that ranks don't matter, and they don't, our relationship with each other here reflects our shared understanding of Dharma practice, that sometimes it does matter, even when we're saying that it doesn't. Most of us, and I'll just talk about myself, since I don't know you all well enough to tell you your stuff. You know, I have these, like I wanted to be lay ordained. I have aspirations in life about things that have to do both with kind of being a member of the Sangha, things with my day job at the university, and so on. And, you know, I think it would be disingenuous of me to say, to not say that, for example, how I think about our three guys. You probably don't know that I call you the three guys, Kokyo, Patrick, and Jean. You know, the color of their robes makes a difference to me. I don't want you to use this against me, but I do kind of, you know, I treat you with honor and appreciate kind of both the level of practice and the teachings. But let me just kind of end again then with Dogen. I think Dogen is, you know, his teacher was Tiantong Rujing, Chinese teacher. And Dogen calls Rujing, he says, my late teacher, the great Zen master. And but there's other places in Dogen's writings where he refers to Rujing as Old Man Buddha or Old Man Tiantong. And it almost seems kind of not so honorific. I mean, I can't really imagine calling Patrick and saying, dude, Old Buddha, call me back when you get a chance. Or something like that. So I just want to close with a...
like old bones, though.
Old bones. I'll remember that. I just want to close with a... it's a poem from Rujing, Dogen's teacher. And maybe it'll kind of open a little bit some of what I've been talking about. The clouds mindlessly drift past the mountain cliffs. 4 years ago or just yesterday is today. In due course, all water returns to the source. 4 years hence or just today is yesterday. Sorry, Hannah's not here because it's part of the Shuso ceremony where you return the staff to the head teacher and say water returns to the source. I don't know, is this originally from Rujing, do you think? Yeah. Okay, well, I think maybe I'd like to stop there. I don't know, would you like to... It's very warm in here. But if you feel like you'd like to have some questions or a conversation, very happy to do that. But first, thank you for listening, being together tonight. Yes.
And transmitted.
Yes.
You know, a real many acts of courage throughout the ancestor stories.
Yes.
And there's one right here in our very lifetime.
Right. For those of you that are new, Catherine Thanis was the abbot here, and she died in 2012. Mm-hmm. And she taught here for how long? Help me out.
20 years.
Trained at San Francisco Zen Center, and great teacher. Thank you.
Did you want to add anything else onto that?
No, I just wanted to acknowledge that. I just, you know, in the spirit of your acknowledging kind of some of the quote-unquote past moments.
Yeah.
You know, like Mahapajapati, you know, tugging at Buddha's robe. Yeah. Come on. You know, I feel like that, you know, right here, we've had that touch us.
Yeah.
It really feels good to say "Kami so what die of show."
Oh, yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Anybody else? It's a warm spring evening, and we can have tea and maybe cookies. Or did anybody bring cake? No? Thank you all. Beings are numberless.